This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Mecklenburg County's Board of Elections decides to cut early voting hours. That even as Governor McCrory asks the Supreme Court to intervene in a Fourth Circuit Court decision to overturn the state's voter laws. Donald Trump makes a stop in Charlotte after shaking up his campaign organization. In the shadow of HB2, Charlotte Pride gets ready for their weekend festival, which is expected to draw large crowds. Olympic swimmers, some of whom trained in Charlotte, including Ryan Lochte, are accused by Brazilian authorities of lying about being robbed at gunpoint. The swimmers, I think, now face charges in Rio, although that seems to be changing moment by moment. The Panthers fold the tent on their training camp, and the Hornets' home gets a new name. Our roundtable of reporters includes WFAE's Tom Bullock and Nick Oxner, a reporter for WBTV News. Good morning to both of you.
Congratulations on getting my name right.
Be the last time. Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, returns, along with Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome to you two.
Good morning.
Thank you.
As elections officials across the state scurry now to comply with the ruling of the Fourth Circuit Court, which overturned the state's voting laws, the North Carolina Republican Party has encouraged GOP appointees to county election boards to, quote, make party line changes to early voting. And apparently Mecklenburg County's Republican-controlled elections board got that message. What have they decided to do?
Well, just a point of clarification, all the election boards
are Republican.
Are Republican-controlled because the governor's a Republican, and that's the way it works. And Mecklenburg County is – they're getting rid of about between 9 and 10% of early voting hours. And that's important in a place like Mecklenburg County for a simple reason. The county is expecting more than half, I believe it's about 56% of all voters this election, and this is supposed to be a very high turnout election, to vote prior to election day. So they're cutting down on the number of hours. They're also getting rid of 2 days of what is known colloquially as souls to the polls, two Sundays where early voting would have been allowed. And the line that you read is actually going to be a big – it's already turned into a bit of a controversy, and I think it's probably going to swell. That's directly from Dallas Woodhouse, the head of the – I mean, he's not the executive – he's the executive director, not the chairman, but the executive director of the North Carolina Republican Party. And right. The email is not – it's one of a couple, at least two that I've seen. And it's fascinating because if you think that the Board of Elections' job is to – make sure that everybody is enfranchised to vote and that voting is set up to be fair, just, and equal across all parties, Dallas Woodhouse seems to disagree with you.
Well, he said North Carolina GOP – well, he said that in that email to elections boards to that they should feel empowered to make legal changes to early voting plans that are supported by Republicans.
And he also made mention that this should be partisan, basically, on a couple of different points. And I'm not exaggerating.
How brazen should we consider that?
I found that to just be beyond the pale. We all know that you know, we have a two-party system, and the two parties generally dominate our democratic, you know, process. But in theory, they are not supposed to be trying to manipulate the basic infrastructure of that democratic process, you know, just for their own partisan,
and particularly
in theory, I don't know if I'm making this make sense.
Well, I think you are, but particularly in light of the Fourth Circuit ruling, which overturned North Carolina's voting laws because they said they were passed by the legislature with discriminatory intent, because they targeted African Americans with surgical precision. The legislature, of course, protested that they had no racial intent here. But it's true that African Americans benefit more from early voting because it gives them more opportunities.
It's really kind of weirdly ironic or unintentionally ironic that he's turning around and doing exactly the same thing that the Fourth Circuit, you know, wrapped the state's leadership across the wrist.
That's exactly what I was about to say. Talk about unintended consequences, right? Democrats and liberals challenge the voter ID law so that they can say, to allow more people to vote. But inside that law, which was passed by the Republican General Assembly, was a guarantee on the number of required early voting hours. And so when you throw the entire law out, you also throw out the entire guarantee on how many hours of early voting you must have. And that's how most of the counties across the state did the Sunday voting and late night and all the extended locations and hours. And so, you know, as soon as that ruling was overturned, everyone on the Democratic side of the politics across the state last week before this really started happening, week and a half ago, everyone said, oh crap, this means they're going to try to use this to roll back early voting. And turns out that's exactly what they're
doing. And they're doing it again. I'm sorry to interrupt, Mike. They're doing it again with surgical precision. Souls to the polls. That's gone in a lot of places or dramatically cut down. And 50% here in Mecklenburg County, it's fair to call that dramatic. And then you also have a decrease in the number of early voting sites on college campuses.
Yes.
In fact, that's another point that Dallas Woodhouse brought up specifically. And why do you take away the early voting sites on college campuses? Overall, young people who vote tend to vote Democrat.
You know, on the face of it, all of this appears to be un-American. How should voters feel about this? I mean, this is the whole point of America is that we elect our elected officials in a fair way, where we all get a chance, one man, one vote, and what they're trying to do is take votes away, or make it difficult to vote. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think history is going to judge those who are trying to do this very harshly. We've been here before. We've been here as a nation. We've been here as North Carolina. Our listeners out there, many of them probably know about what happened in Wilmington, North Carolina back in, was it 1890 or somewhere, 1898 or somewhere around there, with the disenfranchisement of black voters there. There's a very ugly history of this, and we don't seem to learn anything from the past. We keep doing it over
and over. But is this racially motivated or is this numbers motivated? Because there are a whole bunch of people who say that when people vote, Republicans can't win.
Well, I mean,
I think they're hard to separate. Yeah. I think they're hard to separate race from politics, because politics in this country and race, they're so intermingled.
I agree. I mean, when it comes right down to it, and things, of course, can always change, but when it comes right down to it, minority communities tend to vote heavily Democratic.
This whole thing, at best, to me at least, sounds tone deaf, because you have the Mecklenburg County Election Board chairwoman saying that she is not a fan of early voting. Why should we care whether she's a fan or not of early voting?
We shouldn't.
You, and that particular chairperson, what's her name? Mary Summa Potter, I think. Potter, Summa? I'm not sure. I hope I don't butcher her name. But her father, right, is Robert Potter, the judge in the desegregation lawsuit.
I did not know that.
Take that for what it's worth.
Why would you express that out loud, whether you believe it or
not? You're probably in the wrong business if you don't believe in offering the opportunity to vote. And it's important to contrast her statement with the guidance that has come down from the North Carolina Board of Elections, who has done everything they possibly can to try to encourage people to vote, and has also set guidance within the last 2 weeks since the Fourth Circuit ruling came down, telling these boards of elections, hey, remember, we need to, you know, make voting as open to as many people as possible.
I'll go a step further. They have come downright close to begging.
Yes.
The counties to make sure there's a ton of early voting, because this whole thing has a real impact on every voter, which is you could see if they do this too much, you'll see huge lines at the polls. The polls themselves may not be properly set up to handle the volume because the entire system.
And Michael Dickerson says we couldn't handle it.
Yeah, and the entire system right now is predicated on a decent amount in Mecklenburg County, again, more than the majority, 55 to 56% voting before Election Day. If they can't, we're going to have a mess.
This has all been tone deaf even more so because this case is before the U.S. Supreme Court. Roberts has asked to hear arguments. I don't know if those who are arguing against the voter ID law are going to be allowed to introduce new evidence, if you will. But it's not the kind of thing you want to do when a case is before the Supreme Court.
Well, Dallas Woodhouse, who is the North Carolina GOP executive director, also said that, and this is a quote, many of our folks are angry and opposed to Sunday voting, which you already talked about, for a host of reasons, including respect for voters' religious preferences.
That's just such
protection of our families, protection of our families, and allowing the fine election staff a day off rather than forcing them to work days on end with let me finish this. This is fascinating. Rather than forcing them to work days on end without time off. 6 days of voting in 1 week is enough, period. End of quote.
I'm sure he could find volunteers to work on Sunday.
I mean, Glenn is right. I mean,
people would stand in line.
People like this who are saying things like that harsh.
You just said it was
harsh.
A bunch,
history's judgment.
I thought that I heard you say this is a bunch of crap.
It is.
Don't you think people see that? Don't you think they know that people see it that way?
Yeah, but what you have, and this is maybe even perhaps even more distressing, or possibly potentially distressing development, is that the way that people, Dallas Woodhouse and people like him, are justifying those types of, you know, seemingly on the surface unconscionably, you know, bad sounding decisions and rhetoric, is by saying that this is an effort to protect against voter fraud.
Yeah.
Even though there is very little to no evidence that there is a problem.
Well, he used the phrase protection of our families.
Apparently ballots are dangerous in North Carolina.
I don't know what he's talking about there.
Or Democrats is dangerous. Maybe that's what that comes from.
I'm not sure everyone can see through that. I think we are so shaped by our upbringing and our political views that sometimes I think it shapes our perceptions and our perceptions of reality. Hmm. I think there are probably a lot of people out there who would agree with what he said.
And as Tom mentioned, he also this thing also deals with college voting. And Woodhouse said that college campus early voting sites are unnecessary. He wrote, "No group of people are entitled to their own early voting site, including college students who already have more voting options than most other citizens." Is that true?
Well, no. By definition, if you're following the law, every citizen has the chance to vote once. But, you know, it's also a bit of a crazy argument for a very simple reason. He assumes that the only people who can vote on a college campus are college students, and that is not the case. Anybody in that area can go to vote there. This, again, is not – these are handy justifications, not based on fact.
So are they not proving – the people who won this case in Fourth Circuit, are they not proving their point?
Without a doubt. I mean, they're underscoring it in, you know, bright line.
And they're underscoring it as it is before the Supreme Court, which is really stupid.
Yeah, it's as if Dallas Woodhouse just wrote a brief for the opposition.
There is a difference, but for better or for worse, between what Dallas Woodhouse says and what people like, you know, Tim Moore or Phil Berger say. And it really makes me wonder what the lawmakers who are stuck to clean up this mess really think when party officials, which is what Dallas Woodhouse is, and who knows if he's acting on behalf of the chairman or if he's acting on behalf of just what Dallas Woodhouse thought yesterday, you know. And so there's a real difference between the people who are actually making these laws and the rhetoric that's coming out from the party, and I'm, you know, we should link the two, but it's very interesting. It would be interesting to know what the two think.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more of this conversation, and people have heard, I think, that Donald Trump was in town last night, but if you haven't heard what he had to say, we'll fill you in on some of those comments, because it was a pivot in the campaign, a pivot moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Duke Energy, providing grants and employee volunteers to work with local charities and outreach organizations. More information at duke-energy.com/community. And Dr. John Powderly at Carolina Bio-Oncology Institute in Huntersville, a cancer therapy and research center specializing in immunotherapy clinical trials for metastatic cancer. CarolinaBioOncology.org. Digital technologies are changing the way we communicate, as well as the way we write and spell, and with emojis, we don't have to do either. You can say things using pictures. like our caveman ancestors. The use of emojis crosses generations, so the question is, are we dumbing down society or creating a new, creative, visual language? Three language experts share their thoughts on an emoji-free conversation with us Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Donald Trump shakes up his staff after another campaign controversy. Major health insurance Aetna is the latest to pull back from Obamacare, and a group calling itself the Shadow Brokers say they hacked the NSA.
The Friday News Roundup continues on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
Yeehaw! It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. That music was another listener cover of our theme, performed by Peter Gray of Charlotte. We've been asking listeners for their covers for several weeks now. We've started playing them, our favorites so far, during the local news roundup on Fridays. We'll hear another
roundup
cover later in the show. Yeah, let's hear the roundup. I know it takes a while for them to recycle these
roundup.
Parts
up
in the station, but play that again. Play the roundup.
Get along, little doggy.
I like it. If you'd like to have your cover played on the air, head over to the Charlotte Talks page at WFAE.org. It's the local news roundup, and we're talking to Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of the QCityMetro.com website, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Democratic vice presidential nominee Tim Kaine, a one-time civil rights lawyer, had some strong words on North Carolina's voter ID law, and I think, Nick, you went and talked to him in Asheville when he was there. What did he have to say?
Yeah, he made these comments in an interview that I did with him after his rally in Asheville on Monday, and he really did not mince any words when he voices just total shock and outrage at the North Carolina voter ID law. And he said, I'm going to read a quote so I don't screw it up, that quote, "This is just outrageous that somebody would be doing that in the 21st century, taking official government action to deny African Americans the right to vote," and said this was a deliberate state action to carry out those ends. And I was not really taken aback, but I was shocked that for someone in such a high profile would not mince words like that in an era where everyone tries to be so politically correct and say strong things without saying anything at all. And he was very clear that he opposed the law and was happy for the Fourth Circuit decision.
Well, of course, he and his running mate and all Democrats everywhere stand to benefit from the overturning of this law. So.
But it's more than just that. Even the Fourth Circuit, it's very unusual for a court to try to divine the intent of lawmakers. For when you look at the wording of this law, it's very unusual for them to say you passed this law with certain intent, and they effectively did that in this case. They talked about and they said they did it with almost surgical precision, mm-hmm. And that shouldn't be lost. This isn't just a partisan thing. We've had a federal appeals court effectively say the same thing, that this was done with deliberate intent.
So Governor McCrory has he's asked John Roberts, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, to take this case up and look at this before the November election. How likely is that to happen? And even if they look at it before the November election and rule one way or the other, how likely would that ruling be able to be taken
well,
effect
point of, by then? Point of clarification, he's asking for a stay.
A stay.
Which would allow the law to be in place for the November election.
Okay.
There's absolutely no way that the Supreme Court would hear arguments and decide before what, in 80-some days.
Be the fastest proceeding ever.
Ever. In terms of a stay, you never know. I have to say, you obviously know, as I said before, if The people who are fighting the law can use Dallas Woodhouse's memos as a brief. It's a heck of an argument to make before a Supreme Court.
But we have two circuit courts, the Fourth and the Fifth Circuit Court, have both knocked down voter ID laws, and there are differences in these laws. Mm-hmm. And voter ID.
And there are differences in the rulings, right, and the wording of the rulings.
And voter ID is the least of the laws that have been rejected. But we have two circuit courts agreeing. So how likely would the Supreme Court issue a stay when we have two circuit courts agreeing?
Agreeing-ish. See, it's not that they're disagreeing with each other. Mm-hmm. They both have struck down, in essence, some form of voter ID law, however you want to phrase it. But the difference here is a subtle one, and it's not one that's necessarily going to mandate that the Supreme Court step in. Fourth Circuit said, nope, it's gone. This was done with, you know, a racial bias. This is, you know, absolutely illegal. Fifth Circuit was a little bit different. It said this could be done differently is basically a short way of coming up. It's a short summary of what they said. And then you also have cases that are going on right now in Wisconsin, and those cases are still slightly different again. I think there is a high likelihood that the Supreme Court will eventually hear this argument, but you know, you never know. They're still down a person. May wait.
It's possible that the Supreme Court may issue the stay now just so they can say, hold off, go on with what you're doing until we can let all these cases trickle through the court system to come to us, and then we'll issue one guidance all at the same time. The other thing, though, that Republicans actually can point to as a reasonable argument beyond Dallas Woodhouse's emails, is that in the March primaries, the first time that the voter ID laws went into force, there weren't really many complaints and reports of people not being able to vote. And you could point to, among the other things, the State Board of Elections effort that they made to educate people about the voter ID law and to make sure people were equipped to get IDs. That's what they would have you say. And so if Republicans were looking for a valid argument as to why a stay wouldn't irreparably harm voters, they could say, look, we did it in March and June, reasonably fine. Other Republicans have pointed out to the fact that some federal courts in some states are pointing to North Carolina's method for educating voters and the efforts they took to educate voters as the model to correct states' laws and actions. And so both those are, you know, decently valid points.
I would point out again, though, that the actual voter ID requirement is the least of it, actually. Mm-hmm. I think the Supreme Court could find a number of reasons beyond the physical ID requirement to issue a stay. But going back to your initial question, Mike, initially I was all but certain there would be no stay. But after Chief Justice Roberts asked to hear arguments, I wasn't so sure. I'm not so sure anymore. Hmm. I think there could very well be a stay this time around.
And how fast would that have to? How fast would election officials have to react to that? Because now they're backing away and having to fix things that they already put into place.
They've already got the plans.
They've already got the plans.
It would be much simpler for
to go back
to just hop right back to the system they thought they were going to have.
There have been so many changes this election, and we've talked about this week after week. But there have been so. In fact, when I was interviewing Tim Kaine, I asked him about voter ID, and then inadvertently asked him a question about the other ruling that came down from the three-judge panel last week on the legislative races. So, I mean, there are just so many different federal elections rulings in this election, and I think at some point, if we haven't already, we're going to get to the point where voters are just so confused that they'll just stay home.
What I haven't been able to figure out, and maybe one of you can help me with this, how did we get to a place where we're back up against the election? These laws were passed a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I assume that the challenges were filed a long time ago. Mm-hmm. How did we get to this place?
You could just
that's just kind of how it.
People with lifetime appointments move slowly.
Yeah, and courts tend to try to have some sensitivity to these you know real practical concerns about what their impact will have and their timing will have on elections. But like you say, these are folks with lifetime appointments.
And I can appreciate that, but it doesn't seem fair to take your time to issue a ruling and then say we're running out of time.
No, I think that's a very fair question. And I think you know, when you saw the ruling over the federal congressional districts that forced the June primary, like 2 months from the original primary, and when you see the
and those districts had been in place for 5.25 years.
And functionally, really, for like, you know, two decades. But, you know, and so I think we have seen a little bit of of the federal court system, these federal judges doing what they want to do on their timeline in spite of the actual reality of what's happening right now.
Well, Donald Trump was in town yesterday to hold several rallies. I think he was at a 6 p.m. fundraiser at the Westin, another fundraiser earlier in the day at the Trump National Golf Club near Mooresville, then at the convention center for
a rally.
His rally. How many were in? You were there. How many were in attendance at that rally?
I don't like to try to guess crowds. It's not what I do.
But they were loud and supportive.
They were supportive. I'm not going to say they were not as loud as I believe they wanted to be. And there's a very clear reason for that. They were still energetic. They were still passionate. They still loved what they heard as Trump gave his stump speech. But this was a very different kind of speech. And Trump himself was a very different speaker.
Yeah, the teleprompter effect.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And honestly, I mean, this was my fifth Trump event. Yeah. And this is a guy who loves the fact that normally for his stump speeches, everything is off the cuff, impromptu, maybe bullet points that he's going to stick to. But what he did last night in Charlotte was a teleprompter speech that was so scripted with occasional asides, don't get me wrong, that I literally followed along on my phone because the campaign had sent it out, and I could literally just follow along word for word.
You know, I think it's interesting that years ago, President Obama was criticized by Republicans for only being able to speak if he was speaking with a teleprompter. And at least with President Obama and Hillary Clinton, when they read from the teleprompter, you don't realize that they're looking at the teleprompter because their eyes are moving all around the room because they know how to use the left prompter and the right prompter, and there's often a center prompter, and they just kind of flow between the three. Donald is glued to the prompter on the left, and then the prompter.
I keep wondering why.
Well, how come he can read from the prompter and nobody criticizes it, but when President Obama reads from the prompter, it's the worst thing that since sliced bread.
Yeah, he's looking a little hypocritical here at this point, but I don't think he has a choice because when he speaks, you know, extemporaneously, he just goes all over the place.
But even more important,
crazy person.
When did teleprompters become a bad thing?
Yeah, what's wrong with the teleprompter? Yeah. What? Because people used to have printed speeches.
Right. Why is that so horrible?
It just allows you not to have to look down every three words. One of the things that he did last night was something he's never, as far as I know, never done before. He expressed regret. He apologized.
Sometimes in the heat of debate and speaking on a multitude of issues, you don't choose the right words or you say the wrong thing. I have done that. And believe it or not, I regret it. Thank you. And I do regret it, particularly where it may have caused personal pain.
So here's the fun thing about that moment. Everybody in the crowd was laughing a bit at first. Every single one of them, for a very simple reason. They're used to this being a setup for a Donald Trump punchline.
Yeah.
They're waiting for this to turn into, you know, a slam on Clinton or some other rival or President Obama or whatever. And then there was this kind of a little bit of silence as they're like, wait a minute. And he says, I regret it. And then they're like, oh, no, Trump, Trump, Trump. And he comes back. And this time he actually seems to double down on regret. And then you notice as soon as he said, I really do regret it, especially if it caused anyone personal pain, the crowd's silent. They're silent. And I was fascinated because there were so many different things in this speech. He mentioned, and again, I can say thank you to the prepared remarks, he mentioned Hillary Clinton 21 times in this speech, 21 times. Never once did he preface her name with the word crooked. I mean, and I went back through the tape to make sure. He just put the head of a media organization known for catering to the farthest right side of the Republican Party in charge of his campaign. Everybody was expecting this to be Donald Trump unbound.
Red meat.
Well, raw meat, whole side of a cow, like just waiting for the bombs to get thrown, like literally waiting for these attacks to just fly forward. And instead, what they did is came out with what Republican establishment has been dying to see from Donald Trump for a long time now, which was a controlled on-message speech that avoided controversy, mm-hmm. avoided off-color jokes, and stayed on message. I want to see if the candidate buys into that.
Yeah.
But it certainly seems that under new management, that seems where the Trump campaign wants to go.
How do you explain that? Because the guy he hired to run the campaign is from Breitbart News, which is very right-wing. How do you explain that they are doing, he is making him do, what the Republican establishment has been pleading for months now?
He also hired another professional to run to be his campaign manager. Mm-hmm. And she came as a longtime pollster for Mike Pence and is well-known amongst the Republican, I hate to use the word establishment because it seems like it applies to everyone but Donald Trump these days, but from the Republican political consulting sphere. And so a lot of people are saying, you know, she didn't need this job. She took it maybe as a mission to try to write the candidate. And,
or maybe as a favor for Pence.
potentially, right? And so I think this is more her, because the other interesting thing, when Donald Trump announced his new two staffers, he said they're both the best in the political world, you know. But the guy from Breitbart doesn't know anything about politics, because, I mean, he's run a very right-leaning news organization, but he's not a longtime political operative in the same sense that you would think of someone who's been running campaigns for decades, who would typically be running, like, you know, John Podesta.
So go ahead.
The beauty of Trump's non-apology is that it was so open-ended. Mm-hmm. If you were offended by his comments about John McCain, you could fill in the blanks that he was talking about that. If you were offended by his attack on the Gold Star family, you could fill in the blanks that he was talking about that. If you were offended by Crooked Hillary, you could, you know, fill in the blanks. He never said exactly what it was he was apologizing for. Yeah. And that was really smart, because it allowed everyone to say, okay, he was apologizing for that comment that most offended me.
And although his tone was less inflammatory and different last night, he still hit upon some of the same themes.
Anyone who believes Sharia law supplants American law will not be given an immigrant visa. If you want to join our society, then you must embrace our society, our values, and our tolerant way of life. Those who believe in oppressing women, gays, Hispanics, African Americans, and people of different faiths are not welcome to join our great country.
Now, how is that going to play with some Republicans?
I think they're loving the fact, again, he's pivoting more towards a general election electorate. I mean, and note this, one of the biggest headlines to come out of Cleveland was simple, and it was based around the candidate's speech. Normally, they're these glowing, great visions of the future if you put me in office. Donald Trump's speech was, only I can save you, and you need to be saved, right? This very dark feel. In that section that you just played, he said our 5 times, mm-hmm. and it was easy to count because he deliberately overpronounced each one. The message last night was inclusive. It was focused on the middle of the electorate. It was not about fear-mongering, but still stuck to the same principle points that have served him well to this point.
Yeah, the problem, though, is that everybody knows by now that that's his handlers talking. Mm-hmm. That's not exactly Donald Trump.
Well, I was going to ask.
Right.
Just last week he said, I am what I am. I'm not going to change.
Yeah.
And here he is reading somebody's words. Are people going to buy this?
That's how I ended my piece this morning. We'll have to wait to see.
All right. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks, the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members in Cherokee NC's outdoor drama, Unto These Hills, inviting listeners to see the story of Cherokee's history nightly at 8, except Sundays. More at visitcherokeenc.com. And Novant Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, providing comprehensive services and customized treatment plans. More at novanthealth.org/orthopedics. The Friday News Roundup continues with the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. She and a panel of journalists Collins talk about Donald Trump shaking up his staff after another campaign controversy, major health insurer Aetna, the latest to pull back from Obamacare, and a group calling itself the Shadow Brokers say they hacked the NSA. Those stories and more coming up with Diane Rehm. If you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks, WFAE.org. You can get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup or WFAE on Facebook. We're coming right back.
Hot dogs as the great American equalizer.
Nathan's was a place for the common man. It was a place for the celebrity. Didn't matter who you were, you all mingled in that place.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Coney Island's Nathan's Famous, from our series Summer, brought to you by. We'll have the rest of the day's business news and the numbers from Wall Street as well next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
In Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Oh, sorry. Sorry about that. We'll have to play that one again, too, because I talked over it. I'm very sorry. It's the local news roundup here on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. That is a cover of our theme from Philip Wheeler and Jeff Sayer and Garrett Hertzfeld of Charlotte. Garrett tells us that when he heard that Charlotte Talks was looking for listener covers of our theme, he and the others were really excited to cook something up. Those are their words. They call that song, which we're going to play again right now, if we can, they call their song "A Little Voice Is Collins Me."
I like that one.
Yeah, they were about to rock out there.
Well, we're going to hear the whole version of it. They did a whole 60-second version of it. We'll play that at the end of the news roundup here. We're taking entries through the end of the month, and you can find out how to submit your cover of our theme at the Charlotte Talks page at WFAE.org. We're here with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Nick Oxner from WBTV News. HB2 has caused a lot of performers and shows to cancel their appearances here. The NBA, of course, pulled out the All-Star Weekend from Charlotte. Some companies have pulled plans to relocate here, but the Charlotte Pride Weekend, which starts, I believe, tonight, is expected to be bigger than ever because of HB2. How many people are expected to come here today and tomorrow, I guess? Anybody know? Nobody knows crowd expectations. Okay. CMPD, though, must be thinking that a lot of people are coming because they have declared Charlotte Pride Weekend as an extraordinary event, which gives them extra police powers. What exactly does that allow CMPD to do?
All sorts of things. And in a nutshell, without specifically answering the question you asked, I'll talk about something related anyways. It was interesting. CMPD declared this an extraordinary event, and the organizers of Pride Weekend were really unhappy because what it allows police, a whole list of items are banned, things that you, and I don't remember them off the top of my head, which is why I'm not answering
the question. I think bottled water, and they can check your backpacks.
And just a lot of other police scanners are banned. Yeah. You know, you can't bring those in.
I always carry one in my back pocket.
If you're a reporter covering the event, you might have a police scanner on you, right? I know that sounds weird to normal people, but to reporters it doesn't. But basically, it gives police additional ability to cut down on your civil liberties, and I think that is, generally speaking, why the organizers of the weekend were against it.
And yet, we had an interview on WFAE, I believe it was yesterday, with Sarah D'Elia, who spoke with the head of, I think it was the head of Charlotte Pride, who said that safety is important, and they welcome the police, and that the police met with organizers of this event on a regular basis leading up to this, and they had lots of questions answered, and they feel very comfortable with this whole thing going on. Did the police declare this an extraordinary event because they're worried about violence here or because of the violence that gay people experienced in Orlando?
I think it's become pretty much routine now for large events.
Procedure.
Whether it's CIAA or Speed Street, they're all extraordinary events now.
Okay. So that's this weekend, and I think streets are going to beginning to close uptown today for this. It's a big there's a parade. Was it the parade tomorrow? And then there's a big street festival that takes place up and down Tryon Street, right? Or some of the streets. Okay.
And lots of parties.
Amos's South End announced this week that it is closing. And this is another in a series of music venues. There was Tremont Music Hall. The Double Door Inn is closing near CPCC. All of these music venues that are closing are victims to development. And the two in South End, Amos's and Tremont Music Hall, it seems to me, are part of the character of South End, part of the pull toward South End, part of the amenities that people who live in South End want to be near when they move to South End. Are developers killing the goose that laid the golden egg here?
Well, I think I don't know if you can put it. I don't know if I'd put it in that strong a term, but you do. You notice that all of these clubs that have these great histories and traditions and have become a part of the social fabric. They all have one thing in common. They are all close to the center city,
mm-hmm.
and that's where you're seeing tremendous development pressure. And, anybody who has land close to the center city that they think they can develop, there's a lot of money to be made and probably a lot more than you can make running a live music venue. So you're seeing these
yeah, but if flip. But if you just become a bunch of apartments with no amenities, what have you got? Who would want to live there? I mean,
yeah.
When Actors Theater lost their space on Stonewall, it occurred to me that if I were going to build an apartment building – in the face of the 10 billion apartments that are going up right now, why wouldn't I want to find a space for a live theater and call it an amenity in the building?
Or even more, a music venue.
Yeah. Yes, exactly right. And make it an amenity. Maybe they have to close while they build the building, but then they come back.
You do see some developers who are thinking in those terms. Like I know, for instance, at the site across from where they're tearing down the old Charlotte Observer building, Crescent Development is supposed to be building a 30-something story mixed-use development on that spot, and they've made a really strong point of saying that they're going to try to keep a space for public gatherings and for this the type of
you could
smiling.
Move back in.
But this is what they've said now, but it becomes it's a hard thing for these developers to do because when they look at space for those types of uses, they're seeing money that they're not going to make. But I think this is a real question that the city the city fathers need
cities,
to be thinking of.
Chicago, Washington, New York all have places like this mixed in.
Yeah, true.
With everything else, why can't we do that?
I'll preface this by saying I have not spoken with the owners of Amos's, but I did talk with someone who has spoken with them, and my understanding is that this was a combination of a parking issue and a building issue that and the parking issue may have been the bigger issue.
Okay.
And you talk about New York, you talk about Chicago. Those are all places where parking is a lot less important because you have an abundance of public transportation as you say, they're walkable.
Yeah. Okay. Nick, you reported this week on a California commercial bakery with a facility in Huntersville knowingly falsifying food inspection reports. Their food could be contaminated?
That's according to a lawsuit that was filed by two employees, one current, one former. The lawsuit was originally filed back in May. It got removed to federal court, and this week a copy of it showed up in my mailbox somehow, so and others around the city, so we started talking about it. And basically, yeah, the allegations, it's a company called Orange Bakery. They make and sell frozen bread dough that they then distribute to mostly in-store bakeries things. Mm-hmm. The lawsuit says that Orange Bakery's products are baked and sold in Whole Foods, although to what extent the Whole Foods spokeswoman still has yet to clarify for me. Sam's Club as well, according to the lawsuit. And so it says, yeah, this company is required to test for things like E. coli and Listeria, and they were not doing that, and they were falsifying these documents to make it look as though they did.
Any reports of anyone getting sick from these products?
Well, not specifically, because it's hard to know.
And if they're supplying uncooked dough, which mm-hmm. is then baked, doesn't the heat of the baking kill any problems that might be lurking in the dough?
If I had any science expertise, I'd be doing something better than being a TV news reporter.
Okay. Well, thank you for that insight. Well, by now, I think everybody has been remarkably confused by what's going on with the swimmers, the American swimmers down in Rio. There was a report last week, I think it was last week, that Ryan Lochte and several other of his compadres, after spending a night on the town after their last competitive event, were robbed at gunpoint. Ryan Lochte said that a guy put people dressed in police uniforms, one of them put a gun to his head and robbed them. At first, the Olympic Committee denied that. Then they said, no, it happened. Now they're saying it didn't happen because the police are saying it didn't happen. Help me. What's going on down there?
So this has happened so quickly that this actually started happening, believe it or not, this week.
Okay.
It's been developing that fast. And the latest that has come out is the Brazilian police yesterday came out and said they have gone over all of the surveillance tape. This includes CCTV camera footage of the four U.S. swimmers coming back to the Olympic Village, of them at the gas station in question. And that's the key thing here, is this gas station. So they interviewed, the Brazilian police interviewed two swimmers yesterday, and one of them came right out and said this didn't happen, according to what the latest that I have heard, read rather, on CNN, and I just was reading about it before the show started. So that swimmer paid a fine, or has agreed to pay in essence, give money to charity, and then they'll
like $11,000.
Ryan Lochte left the country before this all broke, so he's back in the States. Two guys tried to get on a plane. They were pulled off. Two other swimmers were pulled off a plane. Now they've been allowed to leave, and the security tape at the gas station would indicate that these guys had their cab pulled in because they had to use the restroom.
Mm-hmm.
The restroom was locked. They kicked the door in. They used the restroom, although there's a report that one of them urinated on the wall of the place. And then when they go back to the cab, a security guard allegedly pulls a gun because Ryan Lochte was getting a little out of control, according to one of the news reports. And the swimmers paid for the door, essentially, that they broke.
Mm-hmm.
That's the story that has emerged the last I heard, but it keeps changing.
It does, and the reason you may ask yourself, okay, well, doesn't that, if they paid for the door, doesn't this mean everything is great, fine, and dandy? And it's not under Brazilian law, because lying in a police report is a felony, in essence. So,
and also you're sliming this entire country that is feeling very sensitive right at that moment about
that.
Its international, you know, image.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And to the best of my knowledge, this is really the only incident we've heard about.
Oh, no.
No, it's not.
No. Okay. There are actual, I know, what is it, a couple Australian Olympians were robbed. I think a Brit was robbed. Rio's a dangerous city. Have no doubt about it. This just seems to be an incident that didn't happen.
Okay. So are we to assume that the Olympic Committee, the International Olympic Committee, the U.S. Olympic Committee, and perhaps our diplomatic corps is feverishly working behind the scenes to put all this to rest?
Seems that way. I mean, this could really have a potential to blow up, couldn't it? I mean, if you think about all the ingredients.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I imagine there will probably be repercussions for Ryan Lochte with endorsements. And
absolutely.
And I'm still trying to figure out why the fabrication was even necessary.
Yeah, that's the thing.
They had already paid for the door. Yeah. They got in the car back in the cab, and they went back to Olympic Village.
Yeah, it was totally unnecessary.
And even stranger is it seems like the fabrication began because Ryan Lochte called his mom. I know, but that's true. And it's like, well, why do you need to lie to your mom? Just don't mention the fact that you kind of went nuts at a gas station in Rio.
And you're 32 most, years old.
And you're 32
that's right.
years old.
Like, most
on,
Olympic
man.
Athletes are young. This guy's 32 years old. And Scott Fowler in I used to work for Tom Fowler. Scott Fowler in the Observer today. And the reason we're talking about this is because Ryan Lochte spent a lot of time in Charlotte training.
Right.
And essentially, Scott's showing him the door in his column this morning. He's saying, anybody want to help this guy move? We'll all be there to load the truck.
I mean, he says he's already moving. So, yeah, I don't think anybody's going to be standing in front of him trying to bar him.
But
at
he
this
also
point.
Brought up the fact that he may lose a lot of endorsements in this. And that's really all he has left, because his career, pretty much, he says, is done. He's done.
Yeah.
But he could have kept those endorsements. Why would you do this?
That's a good question.
I think they call it liquid stupidity.
Yep.
Meanwhile, the Panthers have ended their summer camp. They lost their first preseason game to Baltimore last week. They play at 3 o'clock tomorrow against somebody. Who do they play tomorrow?
The Tennessee Titans.
Tennessee Titans. Should we be worried about this, that they lost their first game?
Too early.
I disagree. This was the first preseason game. The Super Bowl is like next week. I think we all need to be all worried.
Well, they play. It's a rematch on the first regular season game.
It's preseason. The key thing here, there are no major injuries. It's a big difference. Than last year. But also, let's not forget this. Even if they lose the rest of the preseason games, the year the Detroit Lions set the new low bar in the NFL and went 0-16, they won all four of their preseason games.
Cam Newton, in an interview with GQ, asserted that America is beyond race now and that the criticisms that he's endured because of his playing style and celebrations have nothing to do with race. And evidently he's taking some heat for that. And Eric, you've written about this, I believe, right?
Well, yeah.
From whom?
Lynn's laughing at me. I wrote about it because he did take a lot of heat, and rightfully so, because everybody knows that that's not the case. I mean, we can look around at all the protests and everything. I think, and I said in the piece I wrote, I think that Cam is just, at that moment he was talking to a writer from GQ magazine. The guy loves clothes, the wilder the better. We've seen the crazy Versace pants he wore. He just wanted to talk about clothes, and he ducked the question, basically. And I basically was saying, maybe we can give him a break this one time. But he did fumble that question.
Okay. Meanwhile, the cable box, Time Warner Arena, is about to get a new name, and that new name is
Spectrum.
And that's all we'll say about that. All right. Are the prices going to change?
Boy, that was informative.
What else can you say about that?
It's finest.
We're going to leave you with one of our cover tunes. Once again, this is from Philip Wheeler, Jeff Sayer, and Garrett Hertzfeld. I want to thank Tom Bullock, Nick Oxner, Glenn Perkins, and Eric Frazier for the Local News Roundup.